When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Charmed, and welcome back to Let Me Ruin Your Life with me, Serena Shahidi. Hello, how is everybody? I'm feeling good. I'm in a good mood. I have a lovely little cup of tea with me today. Two tea bags, lots of milk, lots of sugar. If I wanted to drink water, I would drink water. Okay. But just being a little bit, you know, more mature and classy for good reason. We have another little book episode today where I go through a book and we learn some lessons and we might even make some friends along the way. And today it's The Preppy Handbook, which we'll get into in a bit, but I finally got my grubby little paws on it and I can't wait to learn a little bit about how to be a prep. We'll learn together. But before that, a couple questions from a couple of listeners who need help with their lives, and I'm here to provide. Like I've said before, these are recycled from previous times where I've asked you guys what advice you need. But if you want to DM me at Let Me Ruin Your Life Pod on Instagram, maybe I'll answer a question of yours that might even be still relevant by the time I answer it. So let's get into this first one. I mean, just a great classic question. How do you start talking to random men on a night out? Love your pod, bae. Thank you so much. Great question. Albeit not very relevant right now. If you guys are in New York, tell me if you see this, because it's late January right now, and this year is the most aggressive cuffing season I've ever seen in my life. Because normally people talk about cuffing season and it's like, okay, whatever, like that's something made up by the internet. Like, people still get into relationships when they don't need somebody to have body heat. But all of a sudden, this month, or somewhere around this month, I have seen more couples than I've ever seen in my entire life. Like, you go into a restaurant, everybody's paired up. You go into any establishment now, it's like an ensemble rom-com. It's Love Actually. It's Valentine's Day. It's He's Just Not That Into You. So maybe that's a sign this is like the season of friendship or something, or just like the season of singledom for the rest of us in general. But in life, you gotta chat some people up sometimes, men or women. And in theory, you know, I more so like it when somebody comes up to me. Like, most of the time I think, oh, that's the ideal case. But then maybe I get a little bit bored, have a few drinks, and then I'm over that rule. So what you really need is just a few tried and true lines. That's really what life is all about, is just collecting a few lines. Coming up with something and being like, this is the perfect thing to say in that specific situation, especially like to avoid being too direct or to avoid like really answering a question. Like, I have come up with so many goddamn euphemisms for questions I don't want to answer. What I'm obsessed with lately is if somebody asks like about your relationship with somebody and maybe they're an ex or something you don't want to get into, or that's complicated, you just go, we have a textured history. Stuff like that, it's all about having a Rolodex of lines. So there are some classics, obviously. A little like, what drink should I get? What's good here? What are you drinking? I mean, works best, first of all, if you drink. works better at like a cocktail bar or something like that. If you're at a dive bar and he just has a can of beer, that's a little bit more difficult. Unless you want to ask, like, how's that beer? Is it hoppy? Or however the fuck people describe beer. So that's a classic. You can also, it doesn't have to be something that really sounds like you're coming up with an excuse to approach someone. Like, you could just go, hi, I'm Serena. Preferably, like, if your name is Serena, but you could also replace it with your own name. You could go, hi, I like your hair. A little something simple like that. Another tried and true one. I think this is the easiest one. This is so, like, I'm hardly even talking to you. I'm not even approaching you. You don't even get up for this one. This is like, if you're with a friend and you're talking about something and maybe a little bit of a disagreement over something stupid comes up, even if it's barely a disagreement, like maybe you're like, I love Cameron Diaz. And they're like, really? I'm not obsessed with Cameron Diaz. You know, maybe turn to the hottie next to you and you go, help us settle an argument. Cameron Diaz? Thoughts? That one, I mean, that's so easy. And it's also like, that doesn't have to be a sort of pickup line. Great way to make friends. Just learn about one of their opinions right away. And especially, I mean, men especially, they love to share. I don't know if you guys have noticed this. They do love to share their opinions. They really are obsessed with it. So to give them that opportunity is really, they take it as such a privilege. A little like, do you think this dress is too much? Like, I'm going to a party after this. This doesn't have to be true, by the way. I'm going to a party after this, and I don't want to look too cuckoo. And of course, they'll probably be like, you look amazing. And then there you go. Easy peasy. And also, if you want to be real direct, you could just, are you single? You could just do that. Are you single? And, you know, sometimes they say no. People can be in relationships sometimes. It happens to the best of us. But they're probably going to be very polite out of it. And sometimes even get a free drink out of it because they kind of just feel bad for rejecting you. They don't need to know that you don't give a fuck. They don't need to know that at all. If they just want to buy you a cocktail and then walk away, nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. So that's my very simple advice. It really is simple. I mean, approaching men is so easy. That's why, like, every woman who dates men, especially me, like, we think we have game. And in fact, we probably do not. Like, I cannot be sure that if I were a man, I would be, like, picking up a bunch of girls. But when you are a girl talking to a man, it's not hard at all. Most of the time, you don't need a line. Just, like, bat your eyes. Little smile. Tee-hee-hee. Have a ball. Good luck. I love this second question because this is, like, weirdly such a theme in my life right now. Somebody asks, how do I make my embarrassing moments chic? Oh, my God. This is what I have, like, been doing in my head so much recently because out of nowhere, I just randomly started remembering, like, every embarrassing thing I've ever done in my life. Just out of nowhere. Like, that thing where you're about to fall asleep and you suddenly remember that joke you made in seventh grade that nobody laughed at. I'm doing that awake now. Like, throughout the day, I'm doing that at lunch. And it's not huge, shameful stuff. But I'm remembering, like, every time in my life I've ever pronounced Art Basil as Art Basil. And there are several examples of that. I think it's just because I'm, like, less depressed now, and now I, like, care about my life again, and I remembered that life is real, and all of the things that I've done are, like, actual things that I've actually done, which is a good thing, but now I'm like, oh my God, my past behavior, it's there, it's out there. But listen, okay, it very much helps to remember you are not the only one humiliating yourself out there. Everybody is embarrassing themselves all the time. Like, that's such a big part of life. And you think that that's not the case for you. Like, well, I do it far more than other people do it. No, you don't. No, you don't. You just think that because you know in your head, you remember what all of your worst moments are. You don't know. You don't have a list or a spreadsheet of the worst moments of everybody else you know. You've only seen or witnessed perhaps a few, but I assure you that everybody has a lifetime of like falling on their face in middle school gym class or not realizing that they had lipstick on their teeth or like getting too drunk on a first date and confessing their deepest, darkest secrets to somebody who will not text them after that. And when you witness other people embarrassing themselves, you probably don't even remember most of that. You probably didn't care then and you don't remember it now. You were probably like worrying that there was something in your teeth while your friend was like vomiting on her date's shoes. And who cares about that? It's fine. Good for her. I would say remember that. I would say own it. Tell other people the story. Be like, the most embarrassing thing just happened to me. And then that gives it less power. Because in reality, like, the most embarrassing thing of all is trying to hide your embarrassing moments. Like when someone falls and they like immediately get back up and they're like looking around to see who saw and they're like rushing out of the room. See, now that's embarrassing. Falling, that happens. We make bad footwear decisions. It happens. If you fall, you dust yourself off, big smile, be on your way. Continue with your day. And the last piece of advice that I'll give you, and this has been the most effective one for me, this is really like what gets through my head, is this technique of sorts. So like, okay, when you've done something embarrassing, you can't make that go away, right? You can't subtract. You can only add. You can only wake up each day and say, you know what? I made a fool out of myself yesterday, and I'm gonna outdo myself today. And then what you start to do is you create like this massive pile of humiliation. And now nobody can even dig through that to get to the original thing that you were even embarrassed about in the first place. And there you go. Problem solved. And you might look crazy or foolish, but you're being crazy and or foolish on your own terms. So that's my advice to the people today. And as I said, we're going to be going through a little book called The Preppy Handbook, which is something I learned about at FIT during fashion history class. We were talking a little bit about preppy style and how the fascinating part of it is how it doesn't really change. Like conservative subcultures and stuff like that, they really stay the same throughout time. You know how it is. Those liberals, they're flip-flopping around here and there. They're getting topsy-turvy every other year. But the people who play golf, they don't change. If you're unfamiliar with the Preppy Handbook, it came out in 1980. And it's a sort of like somewhat ironic, somewhat not, like a tongue-in-cheek guide to preppy culture. And according to a very important source, Wikipedia, it really contributed to the resurgence of prep in the 80s, especially because it allowed the masses to learn about it. Like it exposed the culture a little bit, especially in that it talked about the aspects of prep culture that we don't really think about as normal people. The drinking and the smoking and the getting kicked out of prep school of it all. The things that those goddamn preps don't want us to know about. And the book kind of became, you know, even though it's somewhat ironic, it kind of became like unironically a hit where people really used it as a guide. And I was so fascinated by the idea of this book and I thought I would never get my hands on it because it did go out of print in 1995. By the way, people who decide to put books out of print, what's the matter with you? That's a sick, sick job. Especially, I mean, something like this, it's still like very culturally relevant. And it went out of print 15 years after it was published. So now all the copies are like $150 online. But I found a PDF of it on the internet. And I read it. And I found it very informative. I mean, I grew up in the South. I grew up very middle class, but I was in a kind of a nice suburb. So I witnessed a lot of Southern prepdom, a lot of Sperry's. I'll say that much. A lot of Sperry's, a lot of Lily Pulitzer. So much. But I wasn't really exposed to a lot of like New England preppy culture until I moved to New York. Because I didn't know, I knew a lot of like upper middle class people growing up. I didn't know any rich people who like actually went to prep school. And then I met them and I was so fascinated by that culture and just all the rules of it all. There's so many rules. And I knew that there were a lot of rules. Preppy people are not the most free-spirited, as you may know, but I didn't really know what those rules were. So let's learn. Let's get into it. Let's get into rich white people. Okay, chapter one, rights of the birthright. We're starting with the years at home. So naturally, a preppy begins grooming for prep school at the moment of birth. At the moment of birth. This was, I mean, a real culture shock for me when I met some preps and I learned about this. I mean, obviously, I went to public school where you go to whatever school is like mapped out to be the school you go to according to your neighborhood, wherever. You don't have to do anything. You're just expected to show up. There are people I know who were like getting tested as babies. Getting tested on their baby skills. There were professionals like observing how these goddamn people were stacking blocks or something. They were taking notes on how well these babies were like latching on to a nipple. These little kids were like getting put in suits and showing up to school interviews before they learned how to read. And they had to prove to those people that this kid was impressive. They're not impressive. They're a child. What do they know? They have no qualifications. So, naturally, a child has to have a proper preppy nickname. And there's a list of nicknames. They do include, I'm going to be real and say this list of nicknames does include Topsy, Flopsy, and Mopsy. First of all, Flopsy, me, hello, call me Flopsy. There's also Molly, which represents wholesomeness and sometimes an artistic bent, in which case, hair always worn in a scarf. There is, of course, Chip, classic nickname, Chip, who they describe as a future golfer. And don't we know exactly who they're talking about? Even if you don't know a Chip, you know exactly who they're goddamn talking about. He wears a white polo shirt with khakis, and he has like a weak chin, but piercing blue eyes. That's who Chip is. There's also Kip and Skip. Naturally, Kip, free for all, used when no other nickname is appropriate. Skip, for some reason, is a nickname for Steven. I don't understand where these come from. And I always thought that the nicknames like this were so funny. Because you would think that rich people would want to go for something like elegant and classy. You would think that they want to prove that they're that. No. That's Skip over there in the goddamn monogrammed cufflinks. That's Skip with the golf club and the khakis. Skip. This blows my mind about rich people in general. You would think they want to enjoy the finer things. No, they don't. They're buying Sunset Strip modern mansions. And they're naming their son Skip. Get a mink stole. Why do all that? Buy some jewelry. A secondhand mink stole before anyone comes for me. It doesn't count if it's secondhand. I'm sorry. I believe that. As for decorating your house, very important to have pictures of dogs, ducks, horses, boats, birds. You don't have abstract art. These people want to know what the hell they're looking at. They don't want to go to your house and try to figure out what all those trapezoids represent. Have mahogany and brass. Don't have chrome and glass. Looking at you, Sunset Strip. Have pastel sketches of the children. Don't have pastel sketches by the children. That's a funny one, because fuck those kids. They're no professionals. You want me to hang up your art, and it's just a Crayola drawing of the family as stick figures? They're not having it. Have dust. Don't have dirt. Have dishes of beach glass. Don't have dishes of candy. What was the book? I think it was Sex and the Single Girl, where she recommends decorating by having a bowl of cigarettes. I think that's much better than beach glass, because it's useful. It provides something for the guests. Beach glass doesn't even, you know, what can you do with that? It doesn't have any sort of utility. You can't even play with it. It's impolite. Nobody wants their beach glass played with. You know what they do want in their homes? They want ducks. Not literal ducks, but there is so much talk about duck motifs in this book. They want you to have so many duck motifs. And they said, especially if the object has nothing to do with ducks. I don't know what objects do have something to do with ducks, but maybe don't draw a picture of a duck on your bag of torn up stale bread. And these motifs, they're not about the ducks themselves, nay, nay, but about hunting, water, and Maine. All the things worth thinking about. Of course, in childhood, you got to make sure that your child doesn't lose their prep. They can't have too much free time as a kid. God forbid, what are they going to do with it? Do some piece of shit pastel drawings? No thanks. You want to sign them up for piano lessons, ballet lessons, dancing school, especially for stuff like the waltz. That's how I know someone lives a very different life than me, if they know how to do the waltz, because I've never been in this situation where that's appropriate. French lessons, tennis lessons, sailing lessons. Do note, they don't list clown camp, which I went to as a child. By the way, I told my therapist recently a little anecdote that I won't say on the podcast, but I just passively said, like, oh, I did this thing one time, something silly and crazy. And he goes, okay, I'm going to file that in the same place as when you told me you went to clown camp as a kid. We'll probably revisit those. And I was like, okay, I'm down. I love that you care. Also, the horse phase is an important part of female adolescence. Ages 10 to 14, you got to become a horse girl. And I love that they really respect the impermanence of that. They don't let their daughter become an adult horse girl. What happens is she asks for riding lessons. She gets the gear. It influences her wardrobe. She lives that horse life. And then at 14, she discovers boys and it's over. Me, when I got swine flu at clown camp in 2009, and I was like, okay, I'm done clowning around. You know what I mean? What about money? Okay, nice people, they don't discuss money. Or they don't discuss their own money. They do, in fact, discuss other people's money. Where did they get it from? Was it made? Was it married into? Was it stolen? I guess I'm doing it right. I don't check my own bank account, but I do discuss exactly who I know who has a trust fund and pretends like they don't, or doesn't have a trust fund and pretends that they do, which is rarer, but much more fascinating. Preps know when to spend and when not to. You want to buy a bottle of good scotch, you want to get some good cigars, but also walk to work to save a little money. I love this. Little luxuries. Over, like, actual stuff that's, like, practical, but you don't really need. When you can, like, spend $40 on a Chanel lipstick instead of taking an Uber. The formula isn't better than any other lipstick, but it opens in a fun way. You kind of click the bottom open. Also, be quick to pick up small tabs. Friends will remember and pick up the big tabs. So, pay for their vodka soda and they'll pay for dinner. There you go. There is, of course, a preppy value system. First being consistency. Generation after generation has to do the same shit over and over. We know how it goes. There's nonchalance. They don't flaunt their wealth. Wealth whispers, as annoying people say. Isn't that fun when people talk about how they talk relentlessly about how rich people don't talk about how rich they are? I mean, true, but you're the one calling people poor for carrying designer bags. I'm not saying you're necessarily wrong a lot of the time, but you're trying to do the same shit and just hide it. There's also the value of drinking, naturally. Athleticism, which is not for them based on like real strength or skill or anything like that. It's just you have to be athletic in the sense that you can go on vacations that kind of revolve around skiing or golfing or whatever it may be. There's public spiritedness, like loving your school and such, which I've always found rather embarrassing. Why be loyal to an institution? Why do that? It's like being really into the royal family. Why do you love an institution so much? I hated pep rallies in school, especially because it makes no sense why you would do that to teenagers. As a teenager, who doesn't hate institutions at that age? Fuck the man. I'm going to the school that I hate going to, and you want me to get into the gymnasium and cheer for this school? For no goddamn reason? I'm not on the staff. I'm not the football coach. I don't design the curriculum. What do I care if this school succeeds or not? But they also value generosity, if only out of guilt for a lifetime of debutante seasons. Let's talk a little bit about the debutante scene. There's an invitation process where you have to, that's based on coming from the right family. And if you aren't invited, don't appeal. It makes the whole situation worse. It's like yelling at a bouncer when they don't let you into the club. They're just gonna get mad. Walk away, leave some of your dignity. You gotta have an escort to the debutante ball. And the options include virtual strangers, but also brothers and cousins. Rich people culture is very incestuous, can I say? I've been very into rewatching Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which was a fantastic show. And I'm so mad because nobody I know likes it that much. I think it's just because it's not that easy to watch. It's not like a fun sitcom, like a Parks and Rec or something like that, because it's very like almost every line is a joke. It's not Friends that you can kind of use as white noise, but it's such a good show. Anyway, as I was saying, there's a joke in that show about twins who are marrying each other to keep the money in the family. And honestly, that is not that far off from actual rich people culture. It is not that far off. I mean, Cruel Intentions, that step-sibling relationship, where did that happen? A big, beautiful house. Exactly. It happened with rich people. Clueless, even though that was her, like, ex-stepbrother, and it was also Paul Rudd, so who can blame her? But that happened in a big, beautiful house. That's what rich people are like. So the ball itself, usually for the benefit of a charity, of course. And can I just say, this section does not have enough detail for me to understand debutante balls. I think perhaps that would take another lifetime. If anyone would like to explain that to me, if you've perhaps been through that, I would love to have like a debutante ball for, not even for dummies, a debutante ball for normies. For people who had mostly normal lives. Because all I know about debutante balls is what I saw in Borat 2. And this confirms what I saw. It's like girls are presented to the assembly by their fathers. Again. And they and their fathers perform, like do some kind of performance together. Which I also knew about because of Borat 2. I don't know. I don't know what to say about debutante balls. It is truly not much could be more foreign to me, no matter how much I learn about it, from Borat 2. Chapter 2. The root of all prep. The years at school. There's a little bit of a history of prep schools. The synopsis is they came about, I believe, in the 1600s. And then in the late 1800s, early 1900s, more and more of them began to open and they started to get preppier and preppier. And they were very, as they still are now, like exclusive, valued maintaining the ruling class. And another big thing that happened was in the 20s when people started getting more into indulgence and rebellion and all that good stuff, getting thrown out of prep school became a thing. That became almost part of the tradition. Not only do you go to prep school, step one, you get kicked out. Step two, the end. Or not the end, because they probably just go to another school. The interview process, here's what you got to do. You dress conservatively, not casually, not provocatively. You start to dress eccentrically when you get in. It's like a relationship. You start off first few dates normal, charming, lying to them, and then you get to know each other better and you start becoming off-putting, you know? You gotta name drop anyone you know who went to the school or currently goes to the school and loves it. This suggests that you'll fit right in and not become a loner who reads Sylvia Plath. Work. Figure out what sport the school is doing the absolute worst in and tell them how good you are at it. And they really value sports. It's important for the sake of competition, learning sportsmanship, and learning to do unpleasant stuff to build character. Once again, this is not like real athleticism. This is not like sports that require, I don't know, being tall and being able to withstand head trauma. Prep sports include soccer, rugby, tennis, skiing, squash, lacrosse, crew, ice hockey. Prep sports are distinguished with balls that are generally smaller. No comment. Require sticks or rackets, and a ball in flight is preppier than a ball rolling along the ground. Even though soccer and ice hockey are listed as preppy sports. Another important thing for prep school, learning to smoke. Now, schools can never officially endorse the practice, but at least in 1980, some of them allow it if the student has turned a certain age, usually 16 or something, had daddy send his written consent, maintain a designated grade, no lower than a B-, and agreed only to smoke in the restricted school smoking area. God, that's fantastic. My mother told me once, I don't know if this is true. It's entirely possible that I made this up completely, but I think when she went to high school in the 70s, they had like a smoking bathroom or something. In high school, which sounds horrible now, but also kids now, I mean, they are in algebra class vaping down their hoodie sleeves. At least the kids back then had the decency to do it outside of class. That's polite. They weren't lighting up in the middle of the SATs. They also talk about a certain cigarette hold, the underhanded hold, which allows them to hide a cigarette quickly without, like, dropping it and wasting it. You hold it between your thumb and your pointer finger. There is a warning that you might burn yourself doing it. Now let's talk about getting kicked out. The most important part of prep school. Because who goes to prep school to study? I mean, there's, like, a certain social capital to getting kicked out. Because it's kind of the best of both worlds, right? Like, you are rich and preppy, so you can get in, but you're a little bad, so you can also get kicked out. By the way, I won't name names, but a certain friend of mine has gotten kicked out of the same private school as Natasha Lyonne. So it is a bit of an impressive thing. One of the easiest ways to get kicked out is just to flunk out. But if you're a little too smart and you can't manage to flunk, cheat. Simple, just cheat. You can also have contraband delivered. You can organize a nude marathon. Anything sex-wise will do it. Birth control pills, a diaphragm. That's how you know this is a bit of an old book. What was the matter with diaphragms, by the way, that we stopped using them? Let me Google this. Why did we stop using diaphragms? Okay, they're not as effective. Simple answer. 80%? Jesus. Might as well stick anything up there. Anyway, perhaps the simplest way to get kicked out is just to do nothing. Skip classes, skip meals, skip study hall, skip chapel. I certainly would. Remember, in the heart of every private school teacher lies the belief that all youth is fundamentally good and interested in learning. Your task is to convince them otherwise. That's beautiful. Moving on to chapter 3, the best years of your life, the college years. I absolutely, by the way, believe that the college years are the best years of these people's lives. So it starts off talking about Ivy League schools. Now, back in the day, before they even had the word to describe preppiness, Ivy League was used. That was considered synonymous, but the reason now that Ivy Leagues aren't like the pinnacle of preppy colleges is because they're just simply too big, and because of that, they're forced to have some sort of diversity. Can you believe? So preps don't necessarily dominate at Ivy Leagues. They go to smaller schools where everyone's dad knows each other, or whatever. Choosing a major. The favorites are English, history, economics, and classics. Honestly, I like those picks. I like this philosophy that they talk about with choosing a major. It can't be too taxing or too untaxing. You don't want to not make college the best years of your life, but also you don't want to go into anthropology or psychology, because then it gets a little too obvious. I'm there to party. You also can't get too esoteric. Philosophy or linguistics, it's too specific, especially compared to history or English. What do you need to study philosophy or linguistics for? You could just think and talk. And also, nothing too practical. You don't want to do engineering or mathematics because then it shows you're a little bit too worried about your career and you don't actually really care about learning stuff. Honestly, agreed. Agreed. I understand the practicality. Good for you if you make a choice like that. But why are you studying accounting? You're 18. You shouldn't even know how to pay your own taxes at that age. You should be doing them on TurboTax on the last possible day while you're on the phone with your mother and sobbing. You're 18. That blows my mind with people studying something like accounting. That's crazy town. Sex in college. Now, men want sex, but not with other preppies because they have virgin whore complexes. They will, of course, marry other preppies. They have to. But that woman, she must be perfect. She must be crazy about him, and she must be basically his mother. There's going to be, much like Sex and the Single Girl, there's going to be a lot of Freudian stuff in here. This is only the beginning of that. The other category of women that he might want to have sex with is a little bit too threatening for him. She's too smart. She's too ambitious. She's too sexy. Ugh, I feel like I'm looking in a mirror. Now, preppy women are not interested in sex, or at least they don't let it show. They want a Ken doll man who will be good at parties and will never lay a hand on them except on the dance floor. I can name some names. That's the kind of taste you have when you never let yourself date for fun. Although, preppy women, they may have scandalous, a non-preppy affair with a man who perhaps wears a chain around his neck or something. And she will carry that fling with her for the rest of her life, just looking back on it. I'm crazy. I'm cultured. I'm wild. I think I've been that person for a man, by the way. Haven't we all? Because I've always said I love boring men. Not anymore. I mean, I like boring men, but I can't really date them anymore because I have a digital footprint that would throw anybody's conservative parents into an absolute fit. But I used to date a lot of boring men, and I very much feel like there are a few out there who are like, oh my God, that girl, she wore secondhand clothing, and she had non-binary friends. And we went to the box together. I have a wild side. Very that. The rules of prep sex, first of all, no PDA. You don't want to let on that you're seeing each other. And if you so much as, like, give a girl your jacket, that means engagement. That means you are to be married. The girls, of course, don't sleep around, except for that one time with the guy who wore a chain around his neck. The men are, like, basically expected to apologize after kissing a preppy woman. I don't know if Freud said anything about that, but I would love to hear his thoughts. However, you can practice kissing every now and then, occasionally, even real kissing. I assume that means Frenching. But it has to be in a situation like in a cab where there's an ending to it and there's like someone there so you can't get too wild. As for the first time, this is usually after a big party where both parties are drunk and it's not very good. I think my theory about this whole sex thing is that prep culture is too exclusive for it to not feel like incest. You know, I think that's the situation here sexually, because you're dating people who you've known your entire life. The chemistry isn't exactly going to be electric. And it's kind of cute when people tell stories about, this was my childhood best friend and we grew up together and we started dating in college. I can appreciate that as a cute story. I would not want that. I'm not even one of those people who wants to be good friends with someone first. Unless there is like sort of a romantic tension perhaps in the air. Otherwise, it feels incestuous. I'm sorry, that's how it feels to me. Going to parties. You gotta dress right. And you gotta always underdress. Or go completely in the wrong direction. Like wear black tie to a cocktail party. Because then people would be like, oh, she has somewhere else to go. She's very in demand. She's not going to stay at this party all night. You have to be able to drink Herculean quantities without being affected. And of course, hangover prevention is key. Aspirin before bed, and to avoid the whirlies, go to sleep with one hand on the wall and one foot on the floor. I don't think I've ever drank enough to have to do that. Jesus Christ. My hangover cure, by the way, and nothing works 100%, but this is the best option, in my opinion. First of all, you drink a lot of water before you go to bed, if you remember to do that. And then in the morning, you do some electrolytes, perhaps a Pedialyte, 2 aspirin, a B complex, and if you have stuff to do, a lot of caffeine. A lot of caffeine. Now, deviant behavior in general, a sense of humor is something to be acquired. The first example of having a sense of humor for some reason is mooning. Funny. And there's also an entire list of euphemisms for vomiting. Disgusting. Vomiting is not funny. I'm not here for this. I went on a date once. Maybe I've told this story before. With a guy who, I wouldn't probably describe him as preppy, but a very normal guy who was in a frat in college. I didn't know that when I went on a date with him, okay? And he was telling me a little bit about their initiation, which, by the way, if any, there's no possible way that there's a guy listening to this who's been in a frat. But just in case, a little tip, don't tell women about your initiation process. It's unbecoming, okay? He told me a story that I'm not going to repeat, mostly because I think I blocked it out. It was so disgusting. He was talking about how they basically had to play a game where they vommed on each other. And I didn't even know what he was talking about at first because he was like, we booted or something like that. As if it's cute. As if it's like a cute thing that you give a little nickname to. Booted. Vile. Disgusting. Graduation and beyond. Just for the job to pick, you could be a lawyer, which gives respectability. Stockbroker is another option. I love that word. I don't know why we stopped using the word stockbroker, because now it's financial advisor. Ugh. Just the title made that job go from, like, a sexy thing to just someone's dad, and not in the good way. What are the other options? Investment banker, of course. Art dealer, which requires no knowledge of art, just conversational ability and a casual stance while holding a cocktail at gallery events. If you're a bit of a bohemian prep, you could be a furniture restorer. And last but not least, you can be, potentially, a ne'er-do-well, which dictates ceaseless charm and the ability to sponge off others without ever appearing to be a bore or a burden. Brain surgery is easier. Basically the Anna Delvey path, okay? Which, can I just say, classism. Can I just call out that classism? If she went to prep school, she wouldn't be called a scammer. She would be called a professional ne'er-do-well, as she should be. Chapter 4, Dressing the Part, the Preppy Look. There are, of course, some underlying principles here. Conservatism. You wear the same things year after year after year until they fall apart. Doesn't it suck that rich preppy people aren't the ones contributing to fast fashion? Like some rich people are, I mean, obviously the ones running the companies. And there are, you know, a bunch of upper middle class people who do like $200 Shein hauls, which is a lot of clothing. That is so much. I wish we could blame people with old money for that, but no, they're keeping the same things, going to tailors. Good for them. Neatness. Attention to detail. No small percentage of polyester. Practicality. Rain clothes should keep you dry. Winter clothes should keep you warm. I just discovered practicality with clothing. Did you know that you can dress for the season and the weather and the occasion? I just found this out. I've spent my entire life just wearing whatever outfit I feel like wearing. And now I'm like, oh, I can wear pants in 30-degree weather instead of a 6-inch long skirt. Isn't that something? Quality, natural fibers, anglophilia. You can get a little British in that bitch. Androgyny. Men and women kind of dress the same way, which I want to talk about in a bit. Preps love prints, but they love two different kinds. There's the splashy flower print found on pants, dresses, and skirts. This is not a delicate little thing. This is the Lily Pulitzer. This is that, which I despised. Oh, so many people wore that growing up. I will say, though, Lily Pulitzer slayed. Back in the 60s, around then, because those patterns look so much better on a shift dress. On pants, don't get me started, but on a 60s shift dress, slayed. They also like a small repeating motif. Sailboats, tennis rackets, golf clubs, pigs, lobsters, maps of Nantucket. Preppy people love Nantucket. I went on a date once. This is going to make me sound bad. In my defense, I was like, 20. And there's a big difference between 20 and 23. But I went on a first date, and there was no offense to this man. There was no chemistry whatsoever. Like, I've been on some bad dates, but that was the only time that I've been on a date and just looked at a man and thought, he is not attracted to me. He's just not. But anyway, I drank way too much. And the next morning, he texted me and he was like, are we still on for Nantucket? And I did not take him up on that. I mean, if nothing else, for his sake, like, he was not interested in me. I think maybe he thought he should be interested in me, or he was lonely or something. He was visibly not. Okay? Let's get into the look for women. And by the way, in this chapter, there are a lot of, like, long lists of things that preps like to wear. I'm not going to go through every single one. That would take forever. But, okay, let's start with the shoes. Heel height, 2.5 inch maximum, of course. Conservative colors. You got to have your classic pumps. You got to have your Sperry. The preppy shoe. Because the preppiest thing to do is to act like you're on a boat when you are, in fact, not on a boat. Shirts include, I mean, for sure, all cotton, of course. Turtlenecks. Jesus Christ. Hold on. Okay, I'm back. Turtlenecks, all colors. I forget exactly what it's called, but a polo that has a croc on the left nip. An Oxford cloth button-down, just like Daddy's. Maybe it is Daddy's. Okay. I have always said, though, that it is essential much of the time to have a button-down on a night out when it's like spring or summer. Not necessarily Daddy's, but perhaps from a past lover. And you wear it over your outfit, not for like something formal, but if you're going dive bar hopping or something like that. Helps if it's cold. If you're on the train at night, you button it up. If somebody spills a drink, you can mop it right up with that. It's an ex-lover's, who cares? The skirts they list are all ugly. There's only one mini skirt, which is criminal, and it's a wrap skirt, which I always love the idea of, especially because a lot of them are reversible, and I've always believed that there should be so many more reversible garments. But a reversible wrap skirt never sits right. It's never flattering. A kilt, part of the school uniform, of course, but also a lifelong staple. For what? The hell are you wearing a kilt to? Maybe I'm just not in the right places. I've never seen that in my life. At least on a woman. Whatever. Pants and dresses are uninteresting. Accessories. A Bermuda bag, which, if you don't know what a Bermuda bag is, imagine if you had a pencil pouch, but it had a handle that was made out of a cutting board handle. And that's that. Bracelets, all gold, don't match. Pearls, usually real. I wish I was old enough and or rich enough to wear pearls without looking like I got the idea from TikTok. And granted, I do not have real pearls. But I have fake ones that are good enough that the fake opaly color isn't gonna peel off. And every time I put them on, I'm like, I look like a 16-year-old boy who's about to do a dance. Unless I wear them with fully a gown. You gotta have a handkerchief that you never use. A Coach bag, navy blue or wine. Not bright pink like mine, I suppose. A Gucci wallet, no G's on it. Gloves, leather lined with silk or cashmere. That's how you know someone is like rich and or responsible, when they have like nice gloves or a nice umbrella. Something that the rest of us are always losing and then having to buy new ones for like $25. Also, as a woman, you gotta have Eau Sauvage cologne. That's what women are supposed to be wearing. It is famously a men's cologne because perfume is a little too feminine. I feel like Eau Sauvage is a bit of an overcorrection from that. I don't know if you guys have smelled it. It is nothing close to a gender-neutral scent, which, whatever, wear, you know, wear what you want. You could wear a very masculine scent if you're a woman. But it surprises me just how, like, gender-neutral prep style is. You'd think in, like, subcultures that really stick to tradition, they would have some serious gender roles. These women are out here wearing Eau Sauvage. Good for them. But it's surprising. Now, the look for men, it starts off with, of course, you gotta have clean-shaven, hair cut conservatively short, but not too short. You don't want to look like you're in the military. Big, baggy, long boxer shorts. Ugh. As for shoes, of course you have to have the Brooks Brothers loafers. And Gucci loafers. White bucks for garden parties. And Sperry's, of course. Guys in my high school growing up used to, like, the look was Sperry's paired with Nike socks. And that is about the boldest style decision I think anyone could possibly make. I don't even know if that's considered preppy. I don't know what that is. That's something entirely new. Well, for shirts, the classic shirt, of course, is the Brooks Brothers button-down all-cotton Oxford shirt. And do note, there is no such thing as a short-sleeved dress shirt. It is far more desirable to roll up long sleeves. I agree. That's sexy when those forearms come out. You know what I'm talking about. It's also advised that jackets not be too fitted. Love this too. Love this too. I hate a tight jacket. Some guys can pull that off if they're like very, very traditionally handsome. But for the most part, it makes you look like you sell real estate on Instagram. Like, it is so aggressive to have a jacket that is just violently tailored. And it should not be bunching around the armpits. Please. As for accessories, a monogrammed silver belt buckle. They love monogrammed. Cufflinks with your initials on one and your wife or girlfriend's on the other. That's cute. I'm not gonna lie, that's cute. An elegant lighter, even if you don't smoke. Of course. It's like having alcohol in your apartment if you don't drink. Unless, you know, you have issues with alcohol, in which case, do not keep it in your home. But if you don't, and you just happen to not drink too much, it's nice to have that over when you have guests. I recently was out with my friends, and we were outside of Phoebe's, which, if you live in New York, you've definitely at least heard of it. It's a very, like, packed college bar. Like, it's vile. Basically, to get in, you have to just, like, slip a 20 under your fake ID. Although it does kind of hold a nice place in my heart because it's the one place where two guys ever fought over me. Anyway, we were outside of there just waiting, not because we were there, but we were waiting for the crosswalk, and Phoebe's happens to be on the corner, and I hear a voice ask my friend if he has a lighter, and he was like, no, sorry, man, I don't have one. And I was like, oh, I have a lighter. Dig it out of my purse, turn around to give it to this person. Fully a child. Fully, like, a child. And nobody in Thebes is, like, of legal drinking age, but this person looked quite young. And I let him use the lighter. I'm sorry, he was gonna smoke anyway. So, what else? Keychain, one more place for the duck, the sailboat, the tennis racket. I mean, give it a goddamn rest. Straw boater. This is the most hideous hat of all time. I've seen it before. I didn't know the name for it. And when I saw it in this book, I was like, that can't be right. That picture that they have, that can't be right. And I Googled it. It is, I mean, you've definitely seen it. It's one of those straw hats that has like a red ribbon on it. I mean, any picture of someone wearing it, it just doesn't look right. It's just the hat is screaming, take me off of you right now. This isn't right. It only ever looks right with like a bow tie and a striped vest. I don't endorse that. And then, of course, they also have to have their Eau Sauvage. His and hers cologne. Cute. Now, how do we talk to a salesperson? First of all, you gotta be polite, of course. If you're a woman, you want to be using the words divine and darling. Isn't that darling? And for men, you want to be calling things super and outstanding. Let them know immediately that you don't have time to putter about. You're there to get your goddamn khakis. Don't tell him your size. Let him guess. That's hilarious. I feel like most people would rather drown in lava than do this. And I know they're probably just referring to saying like, I don't know, what size do you think I am? But in my mind, someone's just like, what's my size? Guess. With a big old grin on their face. And lastly, but not leastly, don't listen to your salesperson's stories about his friends or relatives. We don't give a fuck. We're not here to dilly-dally. We're not here to putter about. Who cares how your daughter's recovering from that car crash? I want my loafers, goddammit. There's also a little bit about pink and green, and how you know someone is a prep when you see these colors together. This is an embarrassing thing to admit, but in my dating history, okay, I made a video once with my friends Mark and Clara, where I showed them like pictures of men I had dated in the past. Not the pictures weren't on the screen, for the record, I wasn't like doxing anybody. I just showed them and they kind of roasted me for dating them. And one of them, they were like, okay, that man is fully wearing a pink button down and green shorts. And I was like, fair enough. And then I posted that video and I got a message from a guy I had dated like right out of high school. And he was like, was that about me? Because I've worn that. And listener, it was not. I've dated two different men who have worn that outfit, and no offense to them. I mean, I don't really care if I cause offense to one of them, but the one who messaged me, he's fine with me. Chapter 5, the real world, the young executive years. Now, you have to start off in the city because most starting jobs can't get you a house in the suburbs. So you're living in the city, you start meeting friends of your prep school friends, you start joining like clubs where you can play tennis or whatever, you start joining in on the party circuit, which I read this and I was, you know, we have different definitions of parties because I was like, circuit parties? Do preps do G? Like vary that. And then they go on to say the party circuit consists of dinner parties. So, anyway, they list a handful of different types of parties. Of course, the large and the small cocktail parties, the dinner party, the house party, which we also have a very different definition of house parties because I was like, oh, Project X, here we go. Fun. No, this is a type of party that I've never witnessed in my life. Held at a house, usually of a relative, equipped with a pool, tennis court, croquet lawn, where all kinds of activities are planned. You might be served things like whiskey sours or cucumber sandwiches. By the way, I just tried a cucumber sandwich for the first time the other day. I was doing something at a tea house, King's Carriage Tea House, by the way, on the Upper East Side, which is lovely. It's like in a beautiful two-story building, stunning, full tea experience. It's like $40 a person if anyone's in New York and wants to have a fancy experience without spending $400 on dinner. It was lovely. But I tried my first cucumber sandwich, which I was very excited for because I was like, what's the story there? As far as I know, it's just white bread, butter, and cucumber. I wonder what else is going on. Nothing else is going on. It's just white bread, butter, and cucumber. It's cute, but goddamn, tastes like an empty pantry. Now, at this bizarre house party, the sleeping arrangements are very innocent. Everyone drags sleeping bags together and tells ghost stories. How do you drink? Okay, you're adult enough to drink a whiskey sour. And then you're in a circle of sleeping bags telling ghost stories. I'm the bitch at the house party sleepover, dipping people's hands in warm water while I eat a cucumber sandwich. It talks a little bit about the preppy weekend, which often consists of what they call slumming it, which is just where they do something that normal people do. This is just like, you know, when a finance guy is like, oh, I know a good restaurant in Chinatown and it's cash only. And you can just tell that he's so goddamn proud of himself. He is just so cultured. They had a dish I hadn't heard of and I didn't pay with an Amex. Like, okay. There's also the Sunday brunch. 1 o'clock is the standard time. And make sure to note not to expect people to be out of bed at 11 o'clock. Agreed. Do not invite me to brunch before like 12:30. That's not why it was created. If you're eating at noon, that's breakfast. Unless you're either in high school or 80 years old. You might have some activities at Sunday brunch, which may include the Sunday papers, perhaps playing some cards or taking a walk. That is sick. Who do you have to be doing activities at brunch? You have to really be a person who loves just to do stuff. Some people in this world, they just love to do stuff. And I've never really been one of those people, but good for them, I guess. I feel like brunch isn't the time, but enjoy your activities. And the last part of this young adulthood is getting married. There comes a time in every prep's life when marriage is a logical event. They basically, men especially, just get engaged to whoever they're seeing at the moment when they decide they're ready for marriage, or whoever the next one is. It's not even about the person, it's about, like, being ready. And I've heard a lot of people say that this is the case for, like, every single man. I don't know if that's true. I'm not in a man's head, thank God. But I feel like this is definitely true for anyone who's a little bit more traditional. Anyone who has the same career path as their father. If you're dating that guy, don't expect marriage just because you're in love. It's about the convenience. It's about the timing. Chapter 6. You're all grown up now. The country club years. I'm not gonna lie, this chapter was fucking boring. This is the point where you leave the big city when you're almost 30 and you choose a suburb that has a good needlepoint shop and fertile soil for herb gardens. You see what I'm talking about? There's a little bit about joining the country club after 40 when you've made your fortune and become relaxed and you've aged terribly thanks to binge drinking and the sun. And of course, you start sailing. The most preppy sport, often described as standing in a cold shower tearing up $100 bills. I did go sailing once with my friend and her dad. And I did have fun because I was with my friend. It is boring. Nothing happens in sailing. I think nothing happens on boats in general. I've never been on a yacht. I assume it's just sailing, but you're not actually driving the boat and you're on drugs. And with a bunch of old men. So who cares about that? Let's skip to chapter 7. The last chapter, I believe, we're going to learn how to talk like a prep. Because preps have their own way of speaking, a particular tone of voice and such. A few things that are important. Cynicism. Sarcasm. A well-aimed, oh really? Which masquerades as the preppy's sense of humor. Doesn't sarcasm always? Oh, I hate, people describe me sometimes in real life as sarcastic. And I'm always like, no, I'm just kind of silly and kind of a bitch. Like, it's not the same thing. Sarcasm is so 90s, being like, oh, sure. Yeah, I care about that. Okay, Chandler. Jesus. Another important thing, esprit de corps. They value a little bit of exclusivity, so they have to coin some new preppy phrases as a part of that. Things like tapioca, scoots, and G&T action, which just sounds like the lamest man in the world asking to buy you a gin and tonic. You have to have enthusiasm, gotta be calling everything cute, gotta be calling everything great, and have some worldliness. With a little foreign phrase sprinkled in every now and then. Now the lexicon will learn a few words and phrases, such as a little tongue sushi,
which means French kissing.
Ugh. I hate, like, gross words and phrases that refer to sexual stuff. Like, bumped uglies. Vile. We also have Carl Comedian, which means an unsuccessful joke teller. As in, oh, nice joke. You're a real Carl Comedian. See? Sarcasm. Hilarious. Not. That's some good sarcasm. A good not joke.
They have another disgusting word for making out. Chew face.
Ugh. Drugs, which is just used to refer to marijuana, but it makes the person saying it feel like a wild criminal. My first boyfriend used to say this when I was like 17 and I had never partied or anything. And every time I was like, you're doing drugs, gasp. And then I was like, oh, no, you're just gonna smoke a joint and listen to Tyler, the Creator again. Okay. We have another gross one. Hide the salam, which means sex, as in, then we played hide the salam. I'll just let that sit in the air for a sec. And last, my personal favorite, jacked out, which means angry, as in, I got so jacked out. They really got me jacked out. The rest of these words are kind of skippable, but jacked out, I might just start saying that. And that is the Preppy Handbook. I hope you learned something. I learned lots about this culture. I learned, I think, primarily in that preppiness can be mostly described as just people who have wealth, but they only want to flaunt it to other preppy people in this like very small subculture. They just like want to show the people that they went to school with that they have the right brand of polo shirt on. It's fascinating. It really is. And then there was also a lot of Freud stuff, which didn't surprise me, but it is also jarring. There was so much just about like dancing with your male relatives, which isn't that creepy, but it's just one of those things where personally I would rather die. And I love my family. I love my family. But yeah, I would probably rather get shot into the sun than dance with my father. And I don't mean that in an offensive way at all. I think he would 100% agree with that sentiment. As he should. Last thing this episode, I'm going to do my little recommendation. Or I guess not like recommendation, as I said. Like, I don't want this to be me guaranteeing anything is going to be good. But I guess just my media of the week. And I only really have one thing this week. I have not been reading or watching much. I don't really know what I've been doing. This week was kind of like at the end of a day when somebody asks you what you did that day and you're like, I couldn't name a thing. Couldn't name a thing. But I watched a great teen dark comedy, Sugar and Spice, 2001, a movie I enjoyed very much. It's about a group of cheerleaders, one of whom is pregnant, and they could all use some money, and they one night watch a Keanu Reeves movie, and it inspires them to rob a bank. I will say, the thing I don't like about this movie, it is way too short. It's like maybe an hour and 15 minutes without the credits, and I wish the bank robbery was like maybe halfway through the movie. It was like most of the way through. But for me, it was very much worth watching anyway. It's like having a fun fling. It might be cut short, but it was still fun. And this was just such a well-written, dark comedy. Anything about a group of teenage girls committing a crime, Heathers, Jawbreaker, this, I'm in. I'm in. And I also love that one of the characters is obsessed with Conan O'Brien, which is hilarious. That is just, I don't think you could pick a funnier celebrity for someone to be in love with. It's the perfect balance of ridiculous and believable. It's like when you look at pictures of young Jimmy Fallon and you're like, okay, I'm enjoying myself, but these are some odd feelings for me to be having right now. So that's that. Thank you for listening.
I hope you had fun. I hope you have a fabulous weekend. And I'll talk to you next week. Bye.